This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. After the raid that killed Osama bin Laden nearly 4 months ago, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said the U.S. is within reach of defeating al-Qaeda. And last week, U.S. officials said that a CIA drone strike in Pakistan had killed al-Qaeda's new second-in-command, Atiyah al-Rahman. Still, attacks connected to the terror organization continue. On Friday, a radical group with likely connections to al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for a suicide car bomb attack at the United Nations headquarters in Nigeria. A suicide bomber linked with the militant group killed over 24 Iraqis last week in a mosque in Baghdad. And another bombing yesterday in Algeria appears linked to an al-Qaeda affiliate. So what do we know about the state of al-Qaeda? Is the group really on the brink? In a moment, terrorism expert Peter Bergen joins us. But first, we want to hear from you. With less than 2 weeks before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, do you fear al-Qaeda? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at the website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later on the opinion page, Marcia Dyson says black people can be proud of the president and disappointed too, but first, the strength of al-Qaeda. Peter Bergen joins us here in Studio 3A. He's CNN's national security analyst and director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. His latest book is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and al-Qaeda. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Afternoon.
So let me ask you the question I asked our callers. You've spent a lot of time following al-Qaeda. Do you still fear them?
No. I mean, there's a short answer. I mean, I have every professional reason to inflate the threat because my career has been built on examining them. But I can just tell you that the threat from al-Qaeda Central is very minimal. I mean, at the New America Foundation, where I work, we did an examination of every jihadist terrorist case in the United States since 9/11, together with Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And one of the big takeaways is there have been 17 deaths since 9/11, 13 of course at Fort Hood, that are attributable to people motivated by al-Qaeda's ideology domestically in the United States. Now more Americans die in their bathtubs every year by a considerable amount than that. We're not too frightened about people dying in their bathtubs. We should recognize as the 10th anniversary of 9/11 comes up that we would be doing bin Laden's work for him if we remain in a state of constant fear and terror that al-Qaeda is able to pull off something large. Now, which is not to say that these groups, and you mentioned the affiliates in the introduction, some of these affiliates are, they sort of wax and wane. And, of course, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has just been handed a huge gift, which is essentially an incipient or already civil war in Yemen, of which they will try and exploit. And, of course, they almost brought down Flight 253 over Detroit back on Christmas Day 2009. So there is some risk, but it is not it's not the risk we faced on 9/11 or anything close.
You said the central al-Qaeda organization, these affiliate groups, as we have said, continue to be active. Does that mean that the focus should shift from the central Pakistan-based group to the affiliate groups, or do the affiliate groups, are they a different animal entirely?
They're not a different animal entirely. First start, they take strategic direction from al-Qaeda Central. So, for instance, we found, the United States government has found that bin Laden was sending directive to these groups. Now, it's not clear if any of them, all of them got through, but certainly bin Laden was putting out kind of the big picture to these groups, both in internal communications and also in his public statements. So al-Qaeda Central was really the main problem. They're in quite bad shape. The killing of this guy, Atiyah Rahman, over the weekend, or it was announced over the weekend, is not to be discounted. He was the guy who was really kind of bin Laden's number two operationally.
Well, tell me more about him. What do you know about him?
Well, he's a Libyan. Actually, we don't know a huge amount about him, but he's a Libyan who fought in Iraq. He's younger. He's mid-30s as opposed to bin Laden, who was in his mid-50s when he was 54 when he died. He was kind of a new generation. There was something very interesting public about him, which we knew already, which is that he sent a letter to al-Qaeda in Iraq essentially in 2005 saying, enough with, you've really got to stop killing all these Muslims and you're kind of damaging our brand. And clearly he was doing that at bin Laden's behest. So that was the first time he kind of surfaced publicly. But until the bin Laden raid, it wasn't really clear how important a role this guy was playing. He was basically bin Laden's kind of connection to all the affiliate groups and also to his senior advisors.
And that came out because after Osama bin Laden was killed, the raid on his compound showed all this correspondence between them.
Right. Considerable amount of correspondence, and that is according to people who've looked at some of it.
When Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says last month that al-Qaeda's defeat is in reach, what does that mean, do you think, and is it reasonable?
You know, I think that he actually said al-Qaeda's strategic defeat is in reach.
I think that is a distinction
because a strategic defeat would mean that they're not capable of mounting some kind of operation on the United States that would be of strategic consequence. So 9/11 reorientated our national security policy almost entirely, and we put all these resources into the war on terror, now called the war against al-Qaeda and its allies. I don't think he meant that every element of al-Qaeda is sort of suddenly going to lay down its arms. I think that he meant that it wasn't capable of the kind of attack that would really be a cause for serious concern in the United States. I mean, clearly, in that moment seems to be here. Of course, it's very hard for politicians to say that. It's probably a little bit easier for Secretary Panetta. Somebody in a political job has to pay huge costs if that turns out to be not true. And so you haven't heard politicians saying this too much. Because, you know, what if they're wrong?
Well, do you think you might hear them say it a little bit more after September 11th if the 10th anniversary comes and goes without a major attack?
I think that there is still quite a lot of debate within the administration about what exactly to say around the anniversary. Clearly, the main point of the anniversary is memorializing the dead. And I think big discussions of al-Qaeda's capabilities kind of almost is inappropriate at that time. They don't want to hand al-Qaeda any kind of propaganda victory, which, of course, al-Qaeda will try and exploit. I mean, I think we'll hear from them on the 10th anniversary as well. So I think that there is some discussion about what is the appropriate kind of message. I think we will hear something about the necessity for we're a resilient society. We can kind of there may be an attack in the future, but we can kind of come back from that. And of course, the president will be making some kind of, you know, statements at ground zero.
You mentioned al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the group that's in Yemen. There are other groups around. There's, of course, the possibility of homegrown, American-based al-Qaeda-affiliated attacks. Where are you sort of focusing in terms of what might be a hotspot?
Again, going back to this New America Maxwell Syracuse database that any viewer listener can look at on the web at newamerica.net. One really interesting takeaway of these 188 cases that we looked at since 9/11 that are on the jihadi terrorist side, about a third of the intended targets were American military targets overseas or here domestically in the United States. Obviously, if you're motivated by this ideology, the American military, which is now fighting, by my count, five wars in Muslim countries, Yemen, Libya, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq, is a very attractive target, whether it's Fort Hood, Texas, or other cases. But I think as we come to the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we'd be making a big mistake not to actually look at other forms of political violence, and because we're going to release more data that looks at right-wing terrorism and other forms of political terrorism in the United States. One of the really interesting takeaways is that we found on the right-wing side four cases of fairly serious attempts to do radiological bombs, so-called dirty bombs, in the United States coming out of the right wing. They didn't come out of the jihadi terrorists. And so we shouldn't be blind to the fact that there are other forms of political violence which actually may be more threatening. And for instance, you know, the FBI says that 73 people have died in hate crimes since 9/11. Only 17 people have died in jihadi terrorist attacks. So, you know, hate crimes are more of a problem.
Let's hear from Jeremiah in Carbondale, Colorado. Jeremiah, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question was whether I fear an attack, and my response is that I don't feel that fear is an appropriate response. I mean, I think it's a natural. It's a natural sort of response, but I think that if we want to really look at things clearly, I think that that we should be trying to understand what the culture is that, you know, and I realize that there's other threats and that there's other things that are, you know, that's what your guest is saying. But I guess, you know, if we're talking about terrorist attacks and people are afraid of that and there is this fear, you know, since the attacks, my thing would be to look at the culture itself and to understand the culture, you know, to understand what it comes out of and take away that scariness of it being strange and foreign and attacking us. And yeah, understanding that they're people like us and what it comes from.
Jeremiah, thank you for your call. So Peter Berg and Jeremiah is saying that fear is not a particularly useful reaction to any of this, that there are other ways to approach it.
Indeed. And I mean, I think that you will hear around the 10th anniversary the word resilience quite a lot from people, which is covers a lot of things. Physical resilience, we need to have a society that can withstand whether it's Hurricane Irene or a terrorist attack, and they're kind of, you know, there's ways to build buildings and create infrastructure that kind of resist these kinds of either natural disasters or man-made disasters. And also the societal resilience. I mean, if our response to an attack or an attempted attack is total freak out, I mean, we're doing the terrorist work for them. If it's sort of carry on, keep calm and carry on kind of, if that's the response, you know, that's a good response. And I, you know,
it's a fine line though, right? Between vigilance and freaking out.
Right. And yeah, but I mean, the government has done a lot of things to keep us safe. I mean, it's not just that Al Qaeda has been weakened. I mean, there were 16 people on the no-fly list on 9/11. I mean, there are thousands of people, some of whom may not even really should be on the no-fly list. But the point is it is just a much harder target. Al Qaeda, of course, won't change its target set, still obsessed by American commercial aviation. But, you know, the government has done a lot of things. And as a society, we also need to be resilient.
My guest is terrorism expert Peter Bergen. We are talking about Al-Qaeda. After bin Laden and now the drone strike that killed the group's latest number two, how strong or weak is the terror group? A little over 2 weeks away from September 11th, do you fear Al-Qaeda? Tell us why or why not. 800-989-8255 or drop us email, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at the website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts. In just over 2 weeks, we'll mark the 10th anniversary of the terror attacks on 9/11. A lot has changed since that cool September morning over Washington, New York, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But while Osama bin Laden is dead, the terror group he created continues to launch attacks around the world. We're talking today about the capabilities of Al-Qaeda. With less than 2 weeks before the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, do you still fear Al-Qaeda? Our number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. Peter Bergen is our guest, terrorism expert and author of, among other books, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. He directs the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation. We're also joined now via Skype from Cairo by Omar Ashour. He's director of Middle East Studies at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
How would you characterize how important is the killing of Atiyah al-Rahman, al-Qaeda's latest number two?
It is quite important. He's one of the very experienced operatives in al-Qaeda. He operated in Algeria in the 90s when the Osama bin Laden was trying to form a branch for al-Qaeda there. This attempt did not go well, and Atiyah was actually captured by the and imprisoned by the GIA, one of the armed Islamist organizations there. And then he also operated in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Pakistan. So he's a very well experienced operative. In addition, he also has a theological training. He spent 2 years in Mauritania studying Islamic theology, and he's one of the very few theologians, if you wish, between quotations, who are still with Al-Qaeda. And as an Islamic an organization that bases its ideology or claims to represent a form of Islamic theology, when there are no theologians with it, I think this is a big hit to its credibility. And therefore, that's why it's important to remove an operative / theologian between quotations.
Al-Rahman also had the reputation of being very well connected, that he had friends and colleagues in a pretty broad-reaching network. How will that loss affect al-Qaeda going forward, do you think?
If this is true, as I mentioned, he operated in the North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. He was one of the few al-Qaeda operatives who had strong links with Iranian Sunni armed groups. And also, he is Libyan, and he had multiple links with Libyan armed Islamist organizations, including, obviously, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which really transformed and abandoned political violence. But due to the situation now in Libya, they are carrying arms again. So he would be one of the few guys who might want to capitalize on the situation in Libya, on the chaos going on right now, to establish a foothold for al-Qaeda there. So this also adds to the importance of his elimination.
Peter Bergen, do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that I second everything that has just been said.
Let's take a call. This is Brian in Boise. Brian, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
You know, the way I think about it is I'm about as afraid of al-Qaeda right now as I'm afraid of, you know, Nazi Germany. It's kind of like there are these neo-Nazis and there are these groups out there that are trying to do bad things, but, you know, it's hard to be really afraid of them directly in my own life because I know that they've been beheaded, they've been put into shambles, they're disconnected across an enormous region of the earth. And, you know, I know that they're being chased from every possible direction thanks to, you know, the United States and allies. So I know that they exist and they, you know, wish me harm or they wish, you know, some Americans harm for whatever reason, but they're so broken up at this point, it's hard to be really afraid of them because I think their organizing power has just really been torn to shreds.
Brian, thanks for your call. You know, one of the things that, among many, that was so shocking about 9/11 was that it had seemed far away, the threat, not connected to sort of, you know, homeland America. And the war on terror was brought home in this very shocking and dramatic way on 9/11 when innocent Americans were killed. Have we gotten to the point 10 years later, Peter Bergen, that it's far away again?
Well, I mean, it shouldn't have been as far away in our thinking on 9/11 as it was. I mean, you know, after all, late February 1993, a group of guys led by somebody who trained in a al-Qaeda associated training camp bombed the Trade Center for the first time. So, you know, jihadi terrorism had already not only visited America already, it visited at the same target. You know, I think. You know, I agree with what the caller's sentiments in general. The problem is that whether it's in Nigeria, where there's a sort of al-Qaeda-like group you mentioned in the lead-in responsible for an attack in the United Nations, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is coming back and has conducted a huge campaign of violence in Iraq over the last 2 weeks, al-Shabaab, which did do a tactical withdrawal from Mogadishu, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, but controls a good chunk of southern Somalia. I mean, it depends where you look. And, if, you know, certainly the threat to the domestic United States is very, very low. But al-Qaeda-like groups in Pakistan have inflicted a tremendous amount of damage on the Pakistani state, military, civilians. And that's the problem going forward. Bin Laden's most toxic legacy is that he has infected ideologically other groups that don't even necessarily call themselves al-Qaeda. And certainly these ideas are losing popularity in the Muslim world. Dr. Ashour has done a lot of work in this area. You know, they're losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world. But they don't need that many adherents to still cause a lot of problems. The Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany was a very small group of people, inflicted a tremendous amount of damage on the German state with almost no public support. So that's the problem.
Omar Ashour, are they losing the minds and adherents in the message war, do you think?
Yes, they have been losing it for a while now. Mainly on one side, the overwhelming majority of the victims of al-Qaeda are Muslim. On the other side, the failure to do anything positive, whether changing dictatorships or building a strong state, that was all out of the question. So instrumentally, there is a huge failure of al-Qaeda. But also, and then comes, you know, the nonviolent attempts to the Arab Spring, the attempts to change the dictatorships, and they topple two brutal dictatorships in Tunisia and in Egypt without firing one shot. I mean, the states were, or the regimes of Mubarak and Ben Ali were firing the shots, and the protesters were not. So this adds to the instrumental theory of Al-Qaeda, but on an ideological and theological level as well. On an ideological and theological level as well, the basis, the roots of support is almost not there. As I mentioned, Al-Qaeda lacks theologians. There are no sheikhs or imams or credible religious leader that is supporting it.
And what about in Africa? You know, there were these suicide bombings in both Nigeria and Algeria. Is that a sign of increased radicalization in Africa, do you think?
No, you always have the fringe. In Algeria, just a little example, in the 1990s, there was the armed Islamic group, the GIA, which was thousands of fighters. And what remains from the GIA, the AQIM now, the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is a fraction of a faction from the GIA. The GIA splintered to become the Salafi Group for Preaching and Combat, the GSPC, and a small group from a small faction from the GSPC became the AQIM. So it's a fringe group. They are still operating, but what exactly they can do aside from blowing up something every now and then, and something small, it's not really a threat to the top of the regime or take over the country, or their influence and their capacity has been quite undermined.
We have several emails from our listeners here. Nadine says, I don't fear Al-Qaeda because here in Nashville I don't see them as a threat. If they have a presence, it's well hidden, and really Nashville doesn't seem a big enough city to be a target. Michael in Indiana says, in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, I think I may have been a bit concerned of another large-scale attack. But after looking critically at the evidence, I came to the conclusion that attacks such as these require so much in terms of capital, planning, and logistics, it was pretty evident that Al-Qaeda was not going to be capable of doing them repeatedly. Now I live in no fear of a large-scale attack and only believe there's a small chance of a concentrated attack, and then it would likely take the form of the attack at Fort Hood. Tragic as that was, it is not helpful to live in fear worrying about it, as there's little or nothing we can do to prevent them. And Louise says, it seems to me that Al-Qaeda and its associates understand the U.S. very poorly. Attacks on symbolic structures and the military only get Americans angry. Attacks on power stations, stockyards, water supplies, refineries, and other infrastructure that serves personal needs could bring us to our knees in weeks or days. Are they sophisticated enough to realize that, and is something being done to address that possibility? Peter Bergen?
I mean, Al-Qaeda Central and its allies keep coming back to the same target set, which is Washington, New York, and commercial aviation, maybe L.A. I mean, if they wanted, you know, there is no Al-Qaeda in Nashville, as the caller pointed out. But one way to really freak Americans out would be to attack some, you know, say, a power plant or a shopping mall in Nashville. But, you know, Al-Qaeda doesn't. Najibullah Zazi, who is one of the Al-Qaeda recruits who tried to blow up Manhattan subway, he actually drove across the country from Denver to New York to do this. If he had actually done something in Denver, it would have been much more. A, he would have been much less likely to be detected, and B, he would have freaked out a lot more people. But so Al-Qaeda, for these big attacks, they want to do symbolic targets. That isn't, of course, you know, there are, you know, Fort Hoods, and there are other kinds of people inspired by the ideology, but these are not the actual central organizations, which remain very focused on bringing down an American plane, for instance.
Let's hear from Preston in Sheridan, Oregon. Preston, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Rebecca. I really consider it an honor. I find that Talk of the Nation is one of the most credible shows on the radio for dealing with a lot of our current event issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My comment and concern is this. I do not fear Al-Qaeda, but I think that it's been discussed extensively about the radicalization of those fringe individuals in society, whether it be from the New Apostolic Reformation movement, which I think, unfortunately, is linked to the Christian faith, or whether it's Al-Qaeda of the Muslim faith, or other toxic theologies that come out from the other faiths that motivate people to engage in terrorist activities. I think we need to pay more concern to what's happening in society that creates a sense of hopelessness or spiritual vacancy in the lives of citizens around the world that are drawn to these ideologies and these charismatic individuals that promote the kind of actions that we are seeing with Al-Qaeda. I think that it also builds up an industry where that takes away badly needed resources and energy to focus on reducing poverty and to instill a sense of hope and purpose in the world's populations of those and that demographic that that is drawn to those elements where they engage in radical acts. I'd like some comments from Mr. Bergen and others.
Yeah, Preston, thank you for your call. And Peter Bergen, obviously addressing you know, a spiritual lack in society is a lot harder than, say, plotting a drone attack in terms of how you actually handle a sticky issue like that. But on at least a homegrown level in the society that our government does have some supervision for, is there a concerted effort to look at what causes people to become radical? And let me just say quickly, you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
I mean, there's been a concerted effort to look at what the causes for radicalization, and I think the the answer from academics like Dr. Rashour and others would be there's no really simple answer. I mean, there are some sort of answers in group dynamics. A lot of times people join because their brother has joined, and that's true, you know, whether it's militant Islam or militant, you know, some kind of right-wing group. Friends bring you into the kind of movement. So there is something about group dynamics, but there's not, you know, individual reasons vary, and personal disappointments can be one part of it. Some people... but, you know, look at Major Nidal Hassan. On many levels, he was living the American dream. He's a medical doctor. He's a major in the U.S. military.
This is the Fort Hood shooter.
He's earning $90,000 a year. It's not a simple answer. Clearly, religion had some role to play because he became more religious. But, you know, there is no one-size-fits-all. Certainly, the U.S. government now has is thinking seriously about how do we counter violent extremism, not just from Islamists, but just from all forms. And they're looking at gang violence and other things. And the government really recently released a an overall white paper, which kind of indicated that they're thinking hard about it. But there's no simple solution. They don't want to get involved in the situation where the government's securitizing the whole problem, meaning that law enforcement's the only way. I mean, there's lots of ways into kids who have problems. It could be the Department of Education. It can be the Department of Health and Human Services. And so it's a kind of whole-of-government approach. But none of this is easy. And as you say, kind of supplying, you know, somebody's spiritual void so that they have something, some reason for life. I mean, that is pretty hard, whether that's a school shooter or something else. So, but I think there is an awareness amongst the U.S. government that there is a need for thinking about it, and they have been doing thinking about it, and it's certainly the White House has released something relatively recently and is starting to get the other agencies in the government to look at the problem.
And Omar Ashour, do you think progress has been made on understanding why someone becomes radicalized and how to de-radicalize them?
I agree with Dr. Bergen in that there's no actual profile for a violent extremist or a terrorist. There can be many causes, and it's more of a process than really an actual linear relationship, you know, economic grievances or social grievances leading to violent extremism. You know, there's too many research that's been done on that, and it's not necessarily a one direct cause. It's usually an interaction of multiple factors. But on de-radicalization, it's very also complicated when it has to do with a mixture of interacting of pressures on one side, usually governmental pressures if it was an organization or a group of individuals, coupled with interaction with non-like-minded figures that basically try to address the concerns of this particular group the group that we target, de-radicalization, coupled with also inducements showing benefits of abandoning political violence. That also spiritual leadership and organizational leadership helps a lot in terms of de-radicalization. So it's a mixture of leadership concerned interaction with non-like-minded people, pressures from the government as well as inducements.
Omar Ashour is director of Middle East Studies at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK, where he also lectures classes on politics of the modern Arab world. He joined us by phone from Cairo. Thank you so much. And Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst and director of the National Security Studies Program at the New America Foundation, joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Marcia Dyson. I'm Rebecca Roberts. This is Talk of the Nation.